Welcome back to the Ignite podcast. Today, we're delighted to have the founder and CEO of Packsmith, Ben Wunderman of Team Ignite Portfolio Company. We're so excited to be on the journey with you, Ben. Thanks for coming on the show. We'd love to get an intro from you for the audience.
Brian, thanks for having me. So I'm Ben Wunderman, CEO and co-founder of Packsmith. We are building the world's first distributed intelligent fulfillment platform for growing e-commerce brands. Spent the last 10 years in last mile logistics for growing companies, and now building this along with my co-founder, Simon Rubb.
Now, remember, we met you guys very early in your journey. I don't even think you had launched yet. I think we met you 3-4 years ago. And I remember thinking, like, that's an interesting idea. Let's see if it works. And then, lo and behold, a few years later, it really took off. What do you attribute? I mean, explain what Packsmith is for the audience, and why do you think it's catching fire?
Yeah, so Packsmith, as I mentioned, is a distributed fulfillment network, and there's two pieces to our product. We are a platform, but we're also an operational innovation. So on the operational innovation side, we are leveraging the power of folks in their suburban homes, where 80% of e-commerce deliveries go to, for fulfillment. So those folks inside homes around the country, in the suburbs, Packsmiths, fulfill orders for growing e-commerce brands through our platform, through a mobile app. And then brands, on the other side of that equation, have a set of tools and a platform that enables them to get deep transparency into their logistics and understand exactly what's happening with their packaging collateral, their fulfillments, their shipments, and a lot more. So those two pieces together, I think, and we think, really create for an optimized experience for brands who really struggle in the current industry to get transparency into logistics in the way they would with digital marketing or anything else. And on the other side, we provide earning opportunities for folks in homes, work from home, that enables individuals to optimize fulfillment for brands and really optimize what brands are doing at scale, getting distribution through different channels across the e-commerce landscape.
It's quite innovative. I mean, where did this idea come from? I mean, you worked in logistics for a decade, you mentioned. Tell us about how you got into logistics and kind of those experiences and how it informed this startup.
Yeah, I think for my co-founder, Simon, and I, we both grew up on an island in Australia, Tasmania. It's Australia's only island state. It's relatively small, 500,000 people. It's a beautiful place to live, but it is isolated. And Australia generally during the 90s and 80s was isolated from the rest of the world in terms of commerce to some degree, right? And growing up in that environment, both of us were looking for products and ideas from further afield. And the internet for us was a big connector. But we noticed at that stage and were frustrated by how difficult it was to get stuff to our home locations. We would wait months to receive packages, even from the mainland, let alone from elsewhere. And that was something that kind of stuck with both of us in our careers. Simon went to Uber in New York. I joined Lyft in San Francisco. We both moved to the US at around the same time. And then we spent the last kind of 10 years, both of us, in last mile logistics. So not necessarily in freight or shipping in kind of the mainstream of the industry, but creating new opportunities in the last mile piece. And through that, we noticed exactly what was wrong with some of the delivery structures and the way that consumers and brands were able to approach delivery and last mile. And that's where Packsmith came from, kind of understanding of our marketplace background, what could enable this type of marketplace to scale, but also what were the platform features that brands were looking for? And fundamentally, from first principles, what was wrong with the existing industry today for brands who are selling online through e-commerce channels like Shopify?
Yeah. This reminds me of a funny story from my background where after college, I lived in the Caribbean, in the St. Thomas Virgin Islands. My wife and I, we got married down there actually, and or like in our, you know, mid-20s and just living on an island. And back then there was no streaming, let alone really good internet down there. And so we did it was Blockbuster at the time for, you know, the DVDs in the mail. Yeah. And it would take like 7 to 10 days from when you dropped it in the inbox or the mailbox to get it all the way, get the next thing in your queue. So we had to do like 10 at a time just to have enough stuff to watch. Otherwise, like, you know, You could do that, the three DVDs at a time or the five. You had to do 10 because it would take 10 days for that. Anyway, so I empathize with that problem of being isolated and on an island.
Look, I think islands are great to think with, right? They're a great thinking tool because you kind of limit your geographical scope and you're forced to kind of innovate in a very constrained set of conditions. So we often at Packsmith, we use kind of island, what we call island thinking, as a way of driving innovation to the business and to the product. Because if you think too expansively, if you think of the world as one big kind of open geography, then it really doesn't give you the limitations that drives you towards the best solutions to problems. And islands are an example, I would say, of that type of engagement is, with this set of constrained conditions, what can we actually do to improve things in terms of physical availability of products? And over the past 5 years especially, but over the past 10 to 15 years, mental availability of products has grown dramatically, right? Digital advertising, new channels for distribution via the internet. That's changing commerce itself, right? 97% of businesses across the US and in most countries are small businesses. And those businesses are now building e-commerce businesses. But physical distribution, the optimization of the physical world, is still something that's built on the retail infrastructure of the last 30 to 60 years, and not really older than that either. So there's a lot that needs to change in the physical world to support the advances in the digital world. And that's something that we're unlocking at Packsmith.
So let's divide the experience into the two sides, right? You got the retail brands on one side and you got the Packsmiths on the other. Break down kind of how it works for the Packsmith and what's in it for them and kind of what the mechanics are, how it works.
Yeah. So Packsmith sign up online as they would for other kind of flexible working opportunities. One thing that we noticed building this business, and we spent about a year talking to both brands and folks who are in the flexible work economy, and we really wanted to hear what was working and what wasn't in 2020, 2021, especially during the pandemic when people were more isolated at home. What kind of opportunities made sense to them? From our time at Uber and Lyft and other companies, Postmates as well too, we noticed that most individuals in that economy were typically male, right? They were typically folks who might have done something in transportation before, right? And as those business models evolved, that kind of hardened and solidified. And we saw a real opportunity to create earning opportunities for folks who are largely left out of those innovative business models and those types of businesses. And
specifically, you're talking about like Uber and DoorDash and these kind of businesses?
Uber, DoorDash, Uber, DoorDash, Postmates, Lyft, you name it. You know, typically folks who were constrained to their home for reasons, for any reason, right, were largely excluded from those sort of opportunities. And that largely affects women predominantly, and it affects stay-at-home parents, and it affects folks with disabilities, and it affects a whole range of people that are looking for flexible earning opportunities.
Yeah, single parents who need to stay home with their kids and be home for their kids at a very specific time. And
exactly. So we wanted to create some economic viability for earning income for those individuals without leaving their home. And one of the things that we noticed was that the categories that are exploding in e-commerce, particularly personal care and beauty and skincare, fashion, jewelry, collectibles, were all things that could be managed within a home environment. We'd also spent time building out kind of dark stores and cloud kitchens for the businesses that we've built. And the costs of doing that type of micro fulfillment expansion was really, really high. And yet we have across the US and Australia and Canada and many other countries, a whole host of suburban homes that have both underutilized space and, more importantly, underutilized labor in terms of individuals who are looking for those earning opportunities. So that was part of the genesis and the research that we put into this. And the Packsmith today fit generally those sort of profiles. And they receive an optimized amount of inventory from brands that we're working with. We have kind of key algorithmic technology that drives optimization at the SKU level and at the inventory level. And we've built our own inventory management and warehouse management infrastructure that sits behind this distributed infrastructure. And that enables Packsmiths to receive optimized inventory at home, store that in their home environment, and then fulfill orders via the mobile app as they come in. And then those orders are then picked up by a carrier or dropped off at a local carrier location. And we utilize all the carriers that most existing fulfillment providers do. So the postal services across various countries, FedEx, UPS, as well as newer forms, schedule a pickup, right?
The Packsmith can go, oh yeah, I got that necklace. It's in my inventory in my garage. Pack it up in a nice way, put it on the porch, and it's scheduled for pickup at 10 a.m. from UPS or FedEx or whoever, USPS even.
And we can build that in a scalable way is the key thing here, is we can make that scalable with the digital infrastructure that we've built to support this type of work and the algorithmic infrastructure behind it. There's a lot of probability that goes into where orders are going and how they get there. And that is fundamentally geographical knowledge, just like the businesses we've helped build in the past. But at a deeper level, the way purchase behavior works is largely probabilistic as well too. So we're utilizing those insights to drive the right allocation of inventory to the right geographical areas. And then Packsmiths, who have more time than you would have in a centralized fulfillment model, to fulfill those orders and get them ready for delivery.
That's the Packsmith innovation side. That kind of removes slack in the system, right? Because historically you had these distribution centers that had, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of rows of, you know, floor to ceiling inventory. And that was a very efficient model to get going. But it turns out a distributed model can also be very efficient. So kind of walk us through some of the cost savings for the brands and environmental impact as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's worth noting, right, that we built this centralized fulfillment and warehousing infrastructure in the US and around the world, largely based on delivery to retail stores, right, not to individuals in homes. And those are very different models that need to be unlocked in very different ways. To give you a couple of examples there to your point, right, walking across an 18 to 24,000 square foot facility to pick the right product and making sure that pick is correct is a lot harder than doing that in a more constrained, smaller environment. So time is important here. Accuracy is important. And using technology, using digital infrastructure, we can unlock greater efficiencies from the physical infrastructure. And we're also kind of drawing in insights here from our time in automotive and our time looking at different models of approaching production and fulfillment, particularly lean production and flow-based production models, so pool systems. And fundamentally, Packsmith is leveraging the power of a pool system to get inventory distributed through different nodes in a network to end customers faster. So there's two kind of components that really matter to us for our customers' customers, so brand customers, the consumers like us that are purchasing goods on Shopify stores every day. We want faster delivery for those individuals. We've gone through a period of time in which, you know, 30-minute delivery, 1-hour delivery was seen as being kind of the gold standard or the most innovative thing we could do. But most customers are looking for 1 to 4 day delivery versus a 6 to 10 day delivery they're getting today.
Yeah.
Let me just pause
we're kind of conditioned for that. I mean, the 2-day prime delivery, and we're kind of used to like, you know, I can wait a few days for this. And even Amazon now has the little, hey, do you want to wait a little longer for fewer boxes or a little credit on your Prime Video or extra cash back on your Visa? I'm like, yeah, sure, I can wait a week. You know, I don't really need this right away, but I will need it. Or I have just enough vitamins left or whatever it is.
Right.
So how much do these Packsmiths make? What's the kind of the range? And does it depend on how much storage space they have? How do you vet these guys? And yeah, this is a really interesting problem. Do you ask them, you know, obviously you probably ask them their address and how much storage space they have and are they physically able to lift 50 pounds or whatever? Like, how do you vet these guys and gals and get them into the system?
Yeah, so we go through a process of onboarding in a similar way that most kind of flexible work opportunities do. We want to remove as much friction from that experience as possible while validating both where you are physically and your appropriateness to do this type of work. And there's a lot of folks, right? There is kind of 7 to 10 million people, at least in the United States, that are doing this type of work today in various models. And there's a whole lot of more people that simply haven't been offered this type of opportunity where they live or where they're residing today. So we validate folks through that process. We make sure they're a good fit for the platform. We make sure that they are the type of person that will engage with the brand, engage with the products they're working with. And then we onboard them to the platform and they start receiving inventory restocks from the brands they're working with. And over time, they can become more specialized in certain high growth brands, or they can do a range of brands that they're particularly interested in. And that enables them to not only feel bought into the experience of working with the Packsmith network and the Packsmith platform, but also working with specific brands. One of the biggest problems we noticed in this space was there's little incentive for folks in a centralized warehouse model or centralized fulfillment model to care, right, about the quality
of
fulfillment.
It's just a job for them. Yeah,
it's a job, right? And it's some, you know, it's a very fast moving job as well too. And so getting things right means slowing things down, but slowing things down in a centralized model means slowing down output.
Right.
In a distributed model, you have the ability to do more focused work at a slower pace with greater accuracy without necessarily compromising the integrity of output across the network. And that's what really matters both to our brands and to Packsmiths, who can fully engage with that work and really get into working with a particular brand or set of products.
Yeah. So how much are these Packsmiths making? Like, what's the typical, you know, pay? Is it similar to Uber per hour? Or,
So it's, you know, it's a model that also incentivizes folks to do the best work they can within the given amount of time. So 2 to 4 hours a day of work is optimal across the Packsmith network for individuals. And that work is truly flexible in many ways during that time period.
Yeah, you could do it in the middle of the night. You could do it in the evening, tomorrow morning, like whatever. Yeah.
Absolutely.
As long as there's like an SLA of getting it on the porch or getting it dropped off.
Correct, right? Making sure that we're optimizing with carriers. That's where the technology piece comes in. The optimizations that we're building across the shipping networks that we're optimizing for, we're enabling kind of really new ways of making sure that handoff happens with complete confidence. I think there's a lot of interesting work that we're doing there on the tech side. But Packsmith earn anywhere from $20 to $25 an hour up to $60 to $100 an hour per order they fulfill. They are paid per order. And that both incentivizes the quality of work and consistency of work across the network. And that's something that's
amazing.
That
so upwards of 50,
distinct.
60, 70, $80 an hour.
Yeah, absolutely.
For 2 to 4 hours a day. I mean, there's lots of people in middle America or outside of the metropolitan areas, even in the metropolitan areas where that's decent. Yeah. That's a decent living.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And you can work 4 hours a day and make, you know, the equivalent of, you know, $25, $40 per hour. Or like an equivalent 4 hour shift versus an 8 hour shift, like going all the way down to the distribution center and making, you know, call it $20 to $30 an hour. And, you know, you got to drive there and you got to be there for 8 hours and you got to deal with your boss like haranguing you about moving faster and with higher quality. Instead, you're working independently, running your own little business out of your house.
Exactly. And these models have existed, right, for a long time. But the way we're doing it now, engaging, connecting brands with Packsmiths across the country and around the world is unique. And as you point out, right, the both the cost savings for brands, so anywhere between 40 to 70% shipping cost reduction per order is what we're seeing across our customers
today. That's
incredible.
That's incredible. That adds a ton to your bottom line, right? Because what is shipping, call it what, $15-$20 a package on average? And so you can add quite a bit of gross margin to your bottom line.
Absolutely. And the transactional cost of this type of engagement with fulfillment providers is often too high for a lot of brands to really enable them to optimize the scale. You know, when we spoke to brands, 15 to 20 spreadsheets is kind of the average number of spreadsheets that a brand will use to manage things like production, packaging, optimization of packaging, replenishment of packaging and production. And a lot of folks go into these industries and businesses with a passion for what they're doing, right? They may be the next great skincare entrepreneur who has a background in chemical science or chemical engineering, or in the industry and is now looking to apply their background to that problem. But usually the last thing that they have expertise in is supply chain logistics. And it's usually the last thing they want to spend time working on as well too, because they want to innovate on the products and innovate on marketing with their customers, not on simply getting stuff to people's doorsteps and into people's mailboxes or into retail or any other channel. So if we can optimize that for brands across all of those channels, including home delivery, then we're enabling those brands to grow and scale and tying that directly back to both their logistics and their sales growth and sales output.
Yeah. And generally, I mean, cost reductions are also correlated with, you know, carbon reductions. So kind of the carbon footprint of this network is probably less. Have you guys calculated any of your sort of environmental impact?
We haven't done a full kind of life cycle analysis just yet. That's coming soon. But this is something we're extremely passionate about as a team. It's one of the reasons we launched this business was the growing environmental and carbon impact of e-commerce logistics and logistics generally. We've moved from a world, right, in the late 19th century and early 20th century from railroad in the middle of the year and containerization with ocean freight. All of that has driven us towards putting more trucks on the road. And those trucks are having both an impact on our infrastructure, impact on our quality of life in terms of air quality and our health, and an impact on the planet in terms of carbon emissions. As we grow e-commerce, the impact of trucks on the road, more vans on the road, more deliveries grows really, really quickly. Yeah, and e-commerce is growing extremely fast. So we can't turn back the clock on e-commerce growth, and we shouldn't, because e-commerce delivery is actually more environmentally efficient if we do it in the right way and we do it in an efficient way. But we're looking at anywhere from 50 to 70% reduction in carbon emissions by utilizing the Packsmith model versus a more centralized fulfillment model. And we're also now seeing a lot of communities around the country rebelling against the idea of having large fulfillment centers with diesel trucks coming and going all times of the day and night in their neighborhoods and in their communities. And that's something that will continue to become a bigger and bigger problem as this industry grows. So we think we should use infrastructure that already exists, infrastructure that needs to be updated and improved over time, particularly suburban home locations. They're the perfect opportunity to both reduce the carbon emissions of delivery and logistics, but also create sustainable economic incentives that support those reductions. And that's one of the big challenges, right? Jobs or the economy versus environmental or carbon and climate considerations. And we think there's some reconciliation that can happen there.
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
Very cool. Why do you think it took so long for someone like you to do this, right? Because it seems to me like this could have been done 10 years ago, and maybe just nobody from that industry understood, you know, how to kind of marry that gig economy, Uber-like model to shipping packages. Like, why do you think it took so long for a startup to emerge like you guys to do this?
Look, I think the one thing that startups need to focus on is timing, and the timing of when you scale and launch a particular business model. And in our view, the timing wasn't right before 2021 even to make this work effectively, largely because we hadn't reached a point of growth in e-commerce where this was a big enough problem to unlock as a new form of
have the rise
optimization.
Of all these niche long tail brands on one side.
Correct.
All these, you know, sub 10 million revenue consumer brands, the long tail of, you know, just consumer goods. And it really was enabled by Shopify, right? And
absolutely.
And Stripe to a lesser extent, but just enabling this sort of, hey, I'm this person that makes stuff and now I need to ship
it.
And that's a really expensive thing. Yeah.
It really is. And those brands will continue to grow, right? Not all of them will succeed in the same way and they won't all become the dominant brands in their category. But at the end of the day, these are businesses that people are scaling as small businesses. This is the new small business and the new small business model for folks who are looking to be entrepreneurs in those sectors. And that's something that we not only think should be supported actively, buy the logistics infrastructure they need, but it should be enabling them to grow faster and with less pain and headaches. And that up to now has been a massive headache for most brands, is getting stuff out there. And a lot of these brands fail simply because they can't get physical distribution. As we change that, things change. But timing is really important here. And I will say, looking back to the history of marketplace models, especially models that we were part of in the earlier days of this kind of transition into more decentralized or at least distributed approaches to transportation in particular, a lot of that infrastructure was infrastructure we had to build ourselves at these companies. This did not exist in the same ways. And now we have tools and tooling out there, digital tooling that makes a lot of this much easier to grow and scale really quickly. So we're utilizing those insights and those experiences to build what is now a very fast scaling model here at Paxman.
Yeah, that's amazing. So what's the future hold? What, you know, 10 years from now, what have you guys accomplished? What does Paxsmith look like? And what's the vision for that?
Yeah, so in 10 years, we'll be a $8 to $10 billion business across logistics and last mile distribution. And we'll have made life easier, dramatically easier for growing brands in e-commerce. E-commerce will be the driving force, we believe, in global commerce and in commerce within particular categories in retail. And Paxsmith will be there enabling all of that to work efficiently, both across home-based fulfillment as well as across the platform that we're building to support innovation and improvements to the flow of logistical goods. That includes everything from packaging to insurance to financing. All of those are pieces of the puzzle that brands need to unlock. And we're providing a centralized digital environment, digital platform to unlock those particular pieces that brands struggle to figure out easily or have to go to multiple different providers. We bring that together in one centralized digital world, and then we decentralize it or distribute it in the physical world to enable faster delivery and cheaper delivery. So we'll bring down delivery costs. And we'll also be in a world of 1 to 2 day delivery and same day delivery across most of the US and across countries like Australia and Canada as well too.
Yeah. And it kind of reminds me of, you know, the James Barksdale quote, you make money two ways in business, like you bundle and unbundle. And this kind of happens in cycles in business and technology and computing, where, you know, we have these massive cloud data centers, right, that kind of arose about 15 years ago. And now you see actually kind of a push to the edge, you know, a push to micro data centers and micro edge computing, you know, distributed everything. And it's kind of interesting to watch it kind of happen in this way with shipping and logistics. I think it's really, really fascinating. One idea that came to my mind was, you know, what happens when we all have like Tesla robots walking around our houses, right? And, you know, because that's coming at some point. It might be 5 years, might be 10 years, who knows? You know, I was like, maybe. I mean, who knows? I don't know. They got some really incredible stuff in the lab now, you know, especially now they're layering on kind of agent-based large language models to kind of understand the environment, to kind of understand context and reasoning. I think it might be faster than you think. And I was thinking like, oh, well, what does that mean for shipping and logistics? And I thought about it, and I think it means even more speed and cost savings, even for Paxsmiths, right? Like if I had a little Tesla robot, I could probably train it, you know, to do some of the packing for me and kind of accelerate it. What are you kind of excited about? What are you watching in these technological trends for your business?
Yeah, I think one of the, interesting things in this space is, you know, what's going to make the biggest impact on and what's going to drive the most significant improvements across logistics and across tech in general. And there's a lot of attention on AI right now. We like to focus on machine learning plus AI as part of that conversation and really break down on a technical level and be honest about where these technologies are actually going and what the potential really is. But there's been dramatic improvements across other technologies that we've generally kind of taken for granted, say smartphone camera technology or camera technology in general. I spent a decent amount of time in automotive and in the self-driving car industry. And one of the most interesting things was how quickly camera technology was improving and what that meant for both the resolution of data that could be captured. And then with AI and ML, the ability to identify pieces of those images, extract information from that image in a contextual way, and then synthesize that into a useful form for folks. That's previously been work that isn't particularly enjoyable for humans and has a high error rate. So we think about robotics and AI and ML and other innovations as enablers for the power that people can bring to the table, right? The packing table or to the workbench or to the office, and enable them to do their jobs better and with greater ease and greater accuracy. So human in the loop thinking is how we approach it at Packsmith. And we say, how do these technologies actually drive greater efficiency for people and create greater opportunities for individuals in these systems and who are part of these systems? So one thing we're doing is building in AI and ML recognition on the images we capture from each fulfillment, and using that intelligence to drive greater accuracy will help Packsmiths ensure they're picking the right items and that those orders are packed in the correct way. So there's some massive opportunities to help humans be better humans in the way they do their jobs and make their work a lot easier as well too. And that's, I think, where things are going. The replacement kind of theories, I think, are a little bit overblown, at least for the foreseeable future. Yes, there'll be some opportunities that are previously done by humans that will now be kind of taken on by machine learning and AI systems. But generally speaking, we believe that the power of these technologies is how they interact and how we interact with them over the next 5 to 25 years.
Yeah. So we've heard a lot about all the success and all the ways that it's great for the Packsmiths and the brands. For anyone listening out there that may not be a fit, what are some of the things that you look for? You're like, gosh, you know, maybe this brand isn't a fit for what we do. Are there any customers you have to like not accept into the platform?
I think right now we're focusing on the core categories that are really suffering from the problems of the existing logistics industry. So generally lightweight products that are shipping single item or that are shipping over longer distances than they should. You know, most folks don't know this, but most of the orders we fulfill in the country are fulfilled from one or two kind of key areas, right? If we distribute that in a more efficient way, then brands that are shipping lightweight products see the biggest savings and see the earliest savings. So we're focusing on those categories first, and then we're moving into additional categories beyond that. So we wouldn't say anyone is a bad fit for us over the period of us expanding and building this business. But things like apparel and footwear are areas in which we're kind of driving more innovation into first. We want to step back and think more critically about how we approach those categories before we dive into them. So over time, we'll be able to expand into those, you know, more complicated categories and bigger items or more diversified SKU ranges. So we're solving what we think is the biggest problem right now for the brands that suffer that problem in the worst way. And then expanding from there as we innovate. So the sky's the limit in terms of what Packsmith can do across e-commerce and across commerce generally. But we think we need more innovation for certain pieces of that stack before we can really unlock value. Yeah.
Love it. Well, why don't we switch to a quick rapid fire, if that works?
Let's do it.
What's your favorite book that has influenced your professional life?
Yeah, Eleanor Ostrom's work generally has been very influential to me. The American economist who worked mainly in kind of issues of the commons, so governing the commons, is kind of a good work to start with there. The idea that we can, as communities, come up with meaningful solutions to complex problems when we're given a set of rules.
Yeah, love that. What's one technology trend you're most excited about?
I'm really excited about camera technology. I'm particularly excited about smartphone camera technology and the improvements that will drive across every single person who has a phone in their hand around the world.
Yeah, that is pretty radical. If you could go back in time, what advice would you give your 20-year-old self?
Take more risk and experiment more.
Yeah,
and be less focused on directionality and more focused on gaining insights.
Yeah, that's a common refrain I hear from older people. Not that you're old, but you know, I really took that to heart in my 20s and took a lot of risks and tried lots of things and moved around the world, and I don't regret it. And I probably wouldn't be where I'm at today if I just kind of stuck it out at Boeing in Seattle and just, I don't know, I do corporate finance at Boeing. You know, no offense to anybody that does corporate finance at Boeing. I'm sure you're very happy, but I wasn't. So I took lots of risks. What's the most challenging decision you've ever made in your career?
Launching a startup during a time of both global and personal crisis. I think often we think we should stop and wait till things are great before we launch something like startup. I launched, and my co-founder, we both launched Packsmith at probably the most difficult point in our lives, both personally and kind of globally. And that had enabled us to learn really quickly. It was difficult, but it was, you know, it was a big move.
Yeah. What was that moment where you're like, you know what, we're going to do this, even though it's going to come at great personal cost and it's not the perfect time. What was that kind of discussion like?
We've been friends for 25 years, and it was a moment of just, if we don't do this now, we won't do it. We'll keep taking the safe path. And as we grew our families and moved into the suburbs and started to do the things that people do, right, once they get out of the kind of startup intensity in their 20s, we said, if we don't do this now, if we don't take advantage of this moment in the market and our personal lives, even though it's difficult, we won't do it. And that was the kind of conversation we had across the world. We didn't meet each other for another 2 years after that in person. We built this company for the first 2 years completely remotely. Simon in Australia, me here in California.
Wow. And you guys plan on being a remote first company for forever?
Yeah, look, we think being remote first is where things are going in terms of getting the best talent, right? It's a distributed approach to building our own business. But we have centers of gravity, we call them, for the business. Melbourne, Australia, Los Angeles, California, and the San Francisco Bay Area are the three kind of centers of gravity for our team and our business.
Yeah. If you weren't doing Packsmith, what would you be doing?
I would probably, the honest answer is I'd probably be working for another startup in the space, right? Or someone trying to do something interesting in startup land. And one of the reasons we started Packsmith is we didn't find any of those opportunities to be particularly exciting. The deeper answer is I'd probably be trying to engage more deeply on a spiritual journey. One of my kind of former desires was to become a Zen Buddhist priest, and that was a path I was taking for a long time. And
we haven't talked about this, or did we talk about this? I meditate. I'm a big meditator as well.
Great.
Never really got into Zen. I tried it a few times. I did the Vipassana 10-day silent retreat in my 20s.
That was
intense. I think I cried for like 3 days straight. I can't recommend it. It was really intense. It's like ego disillusion, you know. But I got into transcendental meditation like a few years ago, and that is fantastic. They just give you a mantra, you say the mantra, and you go to that magical, liberated, pure consciousness state, and you feel really, really great.
Yeah,
and I look forward to it.
I think it's something that enables me to center my day and my life, right, as best I can. And I think it's a set of practices, right? Essentially a set of practices that ties back to how we engage with the world. And I think both as a leader and a founder, but also just as a person, it's something that really helps me understand and unlock kind of my potential by really realizing that and understanding intuitively the experience in the moment is what stands out. And that's something we try and bring into our leadership and our work at Packsmith as well, too.
Yeah, I love that. So tell us about that. So like you've done some extended retreats. You were going to go full on take the robe Buddhist monk. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was, you know, something I was kind of engaged with very early in my life. I was looking for kind of answers to some of the big questions, like a lot of us are. Yeah. And I also wanted to question a lot of the kind of answers that I was given by my community, by society, by schooling, by myself, right, and family. I think Buddhism and Zen Buddhism in particular, I found to be attractive concepts and philosophies simply because they took a very experiential route to gaining knowledge. And that's something I think often we're missing in the workplace and in life, is getting knowledge through experience and then improving and iterating. Those are familiar concepts to startup folks, but I encountered them first in Zen and Buddhist practice. And that's something that I've maintained a focus on throughout my life.
That's really cool. What's one startup or company you wish you had founded?
Airbnb.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. I just had another thought about meditation. Like you, in my 20s, if I hadn't been married at a young age, I got married at 25, I probably would have done the same. I probably would have went to a monastery and actually taken the robe and spent a year or two or more meditating.
It's a powerful time, right? To engage, and it gives you time to engage, right? The structure of those institutions, and they are institutions, let's not shy away from that, they enable you to unlock, I think, a greater sense of understanding. I think that's super powerful, but I also think engaging in the world, engaging with the world, particularly in Buddhism and Zen, is something that is really significant. So for me, it was more about how I take those learnings and insights from experiential practice and put them into play in the world, both to improve the world in the way that I think is best and that collectively we want to see, but also how do we drive greater understanding of each other and of ourselves? And that's something I think has to happen in the actual world of chaos and noise.
Yeah. I think the world would be a better place if part of physical education in schools was, you know, meditative education.
Absolutely.
You know, it's non-secular, right? It's not,
right.
It's not religious. It's just like, hey, here's a technique of breathing or awareness or whatever it is, mantra. And, is that focused attention, or somewhat focused, semi-focused attention that I think, leads to lots of great things in your life. Yeah, and great. I think all kids should learn it. I've been, having my kids learn meditation, and I encourage everybody. In fact, we offer it as we have a discount for Team Ignite portfolio companies for transcendental meditation. I had one of the leading teachers who taught like Ray Dalio and Bridgewater, Mario, and he was on the podcast, and so we have a discount. So if anyone's listening, get in touch if you want your company to be trained. I guess Oprah trains her entire company, like 400 people in TM. It's optional, but it's like free, you know. What's your favorite city for business travel?
Favorite city for business travel is definitely Melbourne, Australia, because it's such a cultural center for the Asia Pacific region, and Melbourne is a city that's driven so many cultural shifts that I don't think a lot of people realize how impactful the city's been, and it's a city that inspires you creatively, and so it's a city that I've lived in for 5 years, but also a city that I love to return back to and engage with.
I love that. I have never been to Australia. I really need, my wife wants to go really bad. But yeah, I need to go. I guess that's okay. So that's on the South Shore. Got it.
Yeah, we need to go. Board, you know, like most of the cities in Australia, but it is a city that kind of had a similar trajectory to a lot of Western US cities during gold rush periods in the late kind of 19th century. And a lot of that infrastructure still exists, but is now kind of transformed by the way we work and live today. And I think there's a lot of commonalities there, but a lot of interesting differences in what that's driven for Melbourne and for Australia culturally.
Yeah. It looks like a beautiful, beautiful town. I'm looking at pictures there. What's one skill you believe every entrepreneur should have?
Competitive context. I think the ability to look beyond the four walls, right? Or the four, infrastructural digital walls of the business and see what's going on. I think a lot of entrepreneurs believe, right, that they should focus solely on their own business and getting it right, which is true. but I don't think to the exclusion of seeing what is going on in the market. If timing is the most important thing for a startup, which I truly believe it is, then seeing what's going on in the external environment matters for entrepreneurs. And it's something that I think a lot of entrepreneurs don't, a lot of founders don't focus on enough in their journey.
Last question. What's the best piece of advice you've ever received?
Be present. An experience. I think me, like a lot of founders, I'm always looking ahead at what's coming next and pushing ahead towards a particular goal, which is great, right? Being goal-driven is fantastic, but at the same time, sometimes not having a goal and sitting in the moment, being present and experiencing what's happening, that's driven the greatest insights for me as a founder, but also just in my life. And plenty of people have given me that advice over the years, both teachers and non-teachers, and that's been powerful.
And I mean that stems from your meditation background, and it's another reason I love doing this podcast, because I get to hang out with really cool people like you and be present with them for an hour and just learn about markets, technologies, people, their backgrounds, the future, and it gives me an opportunity in our busy, hectic 30-minute Zoom meeting culture to just sit here for an hour with someone cool and just shoot the shit about startups and technology.
It matters, right? And I think it matters very deeply, especially now in the time that we're living. I think we need to do more of it in startup culture, because I think there's somewhat of a crisis of faith, right, that a lot of founders and investors are having. And I think the answer to that is to look and talk and engage more with the experience of building in 2024. And beyond, rather than looking at what's worked in the past. Because I think we're at an inflection point for both startups, for tech, and for societies around the world.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about this a lot on the podcast and articles I write. You know, I think a big part of our thesis is more software eating the world, more AI generating more software. And that's really great as an early stage investor, because that means more and more companies to look at. There's 10,000 a year to look at, a little less this year because of the hangover from 21. But yeah, I think it's just that we're up and to the right in society, and there's like these little blips and, you know, we get scared and stuff, but I think the future's all bright and shiny. So
absolutely. I think, and also it is worth noting, right, that we're still in the early innings of startups and the tech revolution. That's my true belief, and our true belief at Packsmith is we're really early on, right? It feels like we've been going down this path for a long time, but in the course of human history, even the course of contemporary and modern human history, we're just at the beginning of unlocking a lot of opportunities, and we're just at the beginning of democratizing access to these technologies. I think that's a big part of what happens next is how do we make these technologies that some of us have had for a long time or a decent amount of time more accessible, more usable, more reliable. And I think those pieces will drive massive innovations on top of some of the more current stuff that's happening today.
Yeah. That's a big reason we invest worldwide is I don't think it's just about Silicon Valley or California, or even the US anymore. It's about the rest of the world. And, and you could see this in the data, you know, more unicorns than ever being created, outside of California. And I think that trend will just continue. So I'm totally in agreement. So for anyone listening that wants to get in touch, a brand, a Packsmith, how should they get in touch with you guys?
Yeah, they can jump onto packsmith.io and sign up as a brand or a Packsmith and reach out to me, ben@packsmith.io directly. If you're a brand looking to optimize your logistics and distribution for global scale.
Well, this was awesome. I could have talked to you for another hour. I say that every time, but it's true. Thanks so much for coming on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Brian. Great to be here.
Thanks, Ben.